In our branch, we were called the Dungaree Navy, and we basically did not work for any armed forces. We worked for ship companies. In other words, the companies of the ships is the ones that actually governed it. And this was a little bit of a problem for, the military establishment, because we didn't come under their particular venue. So we were sort of a separate breed of people. And that of our group, and this is one reason I appreciate bringing this talk, is talk about the Merchant Marine and what we did, and the sacrifices that we made were very comparable to the other services. And I served from 43, 42, 43, all the way up to 50, about into 1950. So I had a pretty active life aboard those ships. And the Merchant Marine, like I said, we were few in numbers, but the percentage of losses of man killed in action were the greatest of any branches of the service. So I just will say shortly that I've got more than a few friends in the Deep Six. That ships were torpedoed. And if it weren't for the Merchant Marine on both coasts, then of course, where would the supply come from? Where would the invasions come from? So on and so forth. It was primarily operated by ship owners, but we served the military by bringing supplies, troops, men, so on and so forth to the various theaters of war. And in my particular case, I was in on the second wave of the African invasion. And then later on, we went up into Italy, brought supplies up there for that particular invasion. And then the last one we got involved with was the June 6th invasion, second day on Normandy. And that was one terrible experience. And on that particular trip, we started off loading a little over 8,000 tons of munitions onto that beachhead. And believe it or not, guess what? How they offloaded those ships? We just sat out in the harbor right off the beach, and the army had what they called ducks. And we come out and we put a net load of munitions or supplies right into a duck, and then they would haul it up on shore. So it took 3 or 4 days to get that ship off of there. Actually, 5 days we sat out there on that beachhead. We mostly operated those ships in what we call convoys. And have you ever seen any pictures of those convoys? Those convoys had anywhere upwards of 60 to 70 ships to as much as 120 ships. And the distance that those things spread out, believe it or not, was about 35 to 40 miles of ships fore and aft and to the side. And of course, back in 42, 43, when I started in service, was the time of the wolf packs, and they hadn't developed their countermeasures at this particular point. And so the shipping losses were quite high. And I know on the first trip that we took, we lucked up. We were coming up out of Gibraltar after dropping off supplies in a little town called Safi, and that was about 40 miles south of Casablanca in Morocco. Anyway, we went from there up to Oran and then back out of Gibraltar and up off the Portuguese coast in heavy seas. Torpedoed, fired one at us out there, and you could hear that thing scrape along the keel of the ship. Luckily, the thing didn't go off. But anyway, we made it through there and back up into England. So most of the trips that we made were back and forth across what we used to call the pond. And the pond, of course, was the North Atlantic. So we did about 20 trips back and forth across that. That would have been in the middle 40s. And this was prior to the invasion. And a lot of that material we brought up was preparatory to to going in on that particular scenario, D-Day. So basically, my job on board the ship was what we call a radio operator, and of course, this is where the difference between the military and the Dungaree Navy, as we call ourselves. We had a maximum of 35 men that operated that entire ship, and that was divided into the deck gang, the black gang, which was the engineering department, and then you had the stewards, and those were the three main divisions that operated that ship. The same ship, if it were Navy, would have taken 120 men. So you can imagine, with the amount of men that were lost, if they had that many men, what the death toll would have been on those ships. But in my particular case, as a radio operator, I pinch hitted also as a purser, pinch hitted as a medic, and whatever else they wanted to throw at you. And it's the same with the mates. One, they had three mates for second and third, and then above them was a skipper, and I was part of that particular officer group. I was a ensign back in those days. And so that comprised that whole thing. And then each one of those mates had a specific tour of duty. First mate usually handled navigation and things like that. And the second officer handled the deck crew, which would be the ordinary seamen and so on and so forth, maintain the ship. And then the third officer just was a general cook and bottle washer, so to speak. So that was exactly the way those ships ran. And the particular ship that I started out on was a vessel they call the Hog Island. You know where that came from. Place in Pennsylvania near Philadelphia. There was a place that they called Hog Island. And that's where these ships were constructed back in 1918, 1920. And these are the ships that they were still running in World War II, believe it or not. And these were turbine driven. And a turbine is a steam device, of course. You know what a turbine is. And this was their main propulsion system. And later on, when we went to the other ships, the Liberty ships or the Victory ships, which is a little bit different, these worked on a reciprocating engine, steam. And these were cylinders that started out about a foot and a half and went up to about 2, 2.5 feet in diameter. And it would gradually would shift steam from one cylinder to the other. And those ships would get pretty good knots. They would run about 11, 11 and a half knots. And now the what they call the Victory or the sea ships were turbine driven, and they had a different purpose. These are the ships that went in with the troops, because they would get up to 18 to 20 knots. So they needed that extra speed to keep up with the military craft. So you had different in designs and ships back in them days. But the Liberty ship was the main horse, and I'll give you a picture of that one. And some of these Liberties, this particular one that we sailed on towards the end of the war, was a trooper carrier. So we carried troops, and then the last ship we came back on, we carried German prisoners of war on that ship. And I've got that mentioned in a little newsletter I showed you there. So basically, my job was, of course, the radio operator. Equipment was quite different back in that day. And today we don't have any more code. The Morse code is no longer. We use GPS and pretty fancy. So instead of a radio operator on a ship today, they use what they call a technician. So the old frequencies are all changed. Do you know what the frequencies were back in those days? Back in that day, we had what we call long wave, and that would be 500 kilohertz. And or that's 600 meters. And this is where we all range from. 500 was considered your emergency frequency. And then each shore would have a different frequency for their operating frequency. So we would send out, say on 500, call them, and then we would shift to another frequency to get off the emergency frequency. When one of them was what they call 454 kilohertz. And that's where you would operate. from your frequency set. And we stood a regular 8 to 10 hour a day watch. We maintained all that equipment. And of course, if there was an emergency, we'd send out an SOS. But back in that day, you didn't send an SOS. And that's the general distress call. What we had was a series of different codes. If you were attacked by a submarine like we were off of Portugal, well, then that's the night I send out a distress call. But we use three S's. Did-a-did, did-a-did, did-a-did. That's your S in Morse code. And of course, the other one is SOS. Did-a-did, da-da, did-a-did. Three dots, three dashes, three dits, and you run those all together, not separately. So that gives you a basic idea what the radio operator did. And we, maintain frequency. We also had a job of decoding messages. So we had cipher that we had to work with. And then on a side duty, depending on what we picked up and what we call conferences before the ship went out, we got instructions of what to do and what not to do. And we used to listen and then report to the military U.S. naval ship that was in the convoy if we picked anything up. And what we were looking for was the German. And you could tell by the sound of their signal if it was coming from a sub or not, because it had a very peculiar sounding. Yeah, we picked those up. Of course, if you talk to the Navy ship, you didn't get on the radio because that would break silence. Get there with a blinker. You've probably seen those blinkers on ships. And the way you would contact them, you'd send out a series of A's, da-da, 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 which is an A, and that meant attention. And then when the person, signalman on the other ship, saw you, he'd send back a T, duh, okay, transmit. So that's two ways of communicating back in those days. We didn't have this fancy electronics we got today. So life out there was quite interesting. And I remember the first trip very vividly. Guess what we got into off of the Azores? 140 knot wind hurricane. That ship was just all over the place. In fact, when you get those type of things, you just head the ship into the trough of the wind and the wave and just keep her going that way until it gets through. But that turned out to be a bad deal because it tore up the convoy. And you remember the old City of Flint? It's the name of a Hog Island ship. And that's just the one that was captured by the Germans and interned in Norway. It escaped. Well, that ship was in our convoy. She got sunk in that trip. So that's a little bit of history. That would have been back in 43, and it was in January that ship got hit. So that took out three or four ships out of that particular, convoy system. And I think one of the more unusual trips we made was they needed men to go into the Japanese War after the surrender of Germany. They shipped a bunch of us, particularly radio operators and other officers like myself, put them on trains up through Canada and finally down through Colorado, Utah, and finally wound up in San Francisco. Anyway, we hopped a ship there, went up and down the coast, headed over across the Pacific, and about two-thirds of the way across, they dropped the atomic bomb. And well, I tell you, when we got the message through and what strength it was, people didn't believe me. So anyway, when we finally got down to, we went to Melbourne, and then eventually we wound up in Calcutta, the war was over. And so then we decided, well, we'll just go on down to Africa. Picked up a load of copper ore down there, went around Durban and of course around the Horn. Ship went right on back up to New York City. So they're going to ship us back to Frisco. I says, no, thank you. We'll stay put. So here we are completely all the way around the ever-loving world by train and by ship. So that was the end of the war. And I'll tell you, it felt real strange when we came up out of Africa there around the Horn. We opened up the portholes, got some air in, and here's the light flashing all over the place. And boy, that was a funny feeling, knowing that you could now run with lights on and whatever. War was over. So basically, that's in a nutshell some of the work that we did. One of the there's a three CD set. If you're interested in seeing what some of the Merchant Marine did in some of their ships and their convoys and things like this, is this Victory at Sea, and it's Roger Hammerstein's musical on that same note. And in fact, we the Merchant Marine were trying to get it to be our theme song, but so far we haven't made it. And then there's a website also on the computer with Hordosky is a guy's name that runs the Merchant Marine site, which you can pick up a lot of data there too. So basically, this is what we, the Merchant Marine or the Maritime Service. Most people aren't. They're not too knowledgeable when it comes to this particular branch of the service, but these were a service that was organized by the Congress to get men and get them on ships. And so I got discharged as Naval Reserve. So basically I was pseudo, so to speak, in the Navy, because I am a Naval Reserve discharge. And that's what the Maritime Service was. It's just another organization, and now it's been disbanded, so that's not anymore. So this is who we are, my friend. No sense of talking about the submarines being shot or whatever, and things like that. We've seen those people come up and shot, depth charge, but forget that part of the war, my friend. When you realize that every time one of those subs went down, 60 to 80 men perished. And that's not a very good feeling.